And then Emanuela Delgado from Georgetown University. I'm interested in theory and simulation of soft materials, especially the mechanical properties. So maybe I can just repeat, because some people were not here, that in the next couple of weeks, since they are the last weeks of the program, we will try to focus on discussions and try to summarize what's a lot of the thoughts that have been running through the program. So we will have only two talks per week, and then the rest of the time, our usual common slots will be dedicated to discussions. And except from the Blackboard talk that will happen on Monday by Mike, and it's a KITP event, all our talks will be in the small seminar room from next week on.
Okay.
Talks and discussions, both of them. Okay, so I basically wanted to, let's see if this works. Yeah. I wanted to talk about yielding and fluidization of soft solids, directly connected to a lot of things that Suzanne was explaining yesterday. My perspective is going to be more from sort of microscopic simulation, so it will be a bit different, although very closely related to a number of things that she talked about. And this is the work I want to discuss is actually been done by Vishwas Vasish, that was a postdoc with me at Georgetown University, and Gabriel, he's an undergraduate student, actually great undergrad from Yale, that worked with us for over the summer. Okay. So what I'm interested in particular is the case that Suzanne was discussing yesterday. So let's say that my material to start with is actually a solid. Okay, so she was considering the case of soft glassy material. And so to start with, I have something that has a modulus, and I'm thinking, you know, something like mayonnaise on bread. And so if I in fact, it can at rest, it will sort of stay there, but then I can push on it and deform it and eventually make it flow. And so if I look at the stress as function of the strain, this is the shear stress, the one thing is that no matter if this is mayonnaise or cement or paint or some other type of soft solid material, I will see basically an elastic, a first elastic response, and then the stress will overshoot, and then it will relax to a steady state value that actually will depend on the where the material starts sort of flowing, but this the stress at which it flows actually will depend on the shear rate that I've used to deform the material in a way that it's fairly non-linear. And so these are data actually from experiments on some sort of mayonnaise that my colleague Dan Blair worked on. Works on at Georgetown University, and so you have this low, very weak dependence on the rate at low rates, and then an increasing and stronger dependence. And we have had several discussions about this in the beginning of the program about the type of models that can describe this type of behaviors. And Suzanne was mentioning also this type of flow curve yesterday. So the way I'm going to look at this system is now using the idea of a dense suspension, but a dense suspension to me will mean something very extreme. So it's something that is so dense that, in fact, it's actually elastic, prevalently elastic to start with. And so the way I'm going to look into this is to consider a model in which I have a very dense assembly of particles. I want to deal with the large systems, and I will have size polydispersity to avoid crystallization or obvious issues of crystallization. And I'm really, when I say dense, I really say very, very dense. So something like 78% in volume fraction. And the way I'm going to model this particle, it's basically with a short range repulsion. Okay, so they are sort of soft in the sense that they can overlap, but there is a very strong repulsion and contact. And so if I want to connect to things that we have, at least my thought with respect to what has been, what we have discussed in the first part of the program, right? So we have considered that the stress, if now this indicates just in general the stress tensor in my material, it will have in principle a part that is due, let's say, to the particle and the part that is due to the fluid. And so we've had a lot of discussions about actually what is the role of these two terms and how to include information from the microstructure that will obviously contribute to this. In most of the cases that we have discussed, I think that people would had in mind was that these two terms are sort of comparable in magnitude, and I can think of the interaction, for example, if we think about the two fluid models for the dense suspension, I can think of the interaction between the particle mainly in terms of collision between particles that will, of course, be affected by the long-range hydrodynamic interaction. So it will contain this term itself to contain different terms. But in my case, actually, the situation is that the particle don't actually collide. I mean, they are just stuck together. And so what happens is that this term is actually the determinant term, and it's much larger than the part that comes from the fluid. And so I'm mainly looking in the type of studies and in the way I look at the material, I will be mainly focused about the role of the contribution of the stresses to the microstructure that comes from the fluid. So the way I want to address this is basically to have my microscopic degrees of freedom, which are the particle positions. And then what I want to do is that I have a model for the particle interaction, which will give me some forces between the particle. And as I said, these forces are going to be very strong, and the particles are completely localized in the neighborhood that is formed by all the other particles, okay? And to start with, at least. And so what I will want to do is to solve the equation of motion for this system and to try to obtain some insight from the microscopic information that I have by addressing the problem at the level of these microscopic degrees of freedom for the macroscopic properties of the material, in terms of mechanics and in terms of dynamics. And so I can deal with this problem in different way. When I do this, as you see, I want to be able to deal with large number of particles, so I'm going to make some compromise on the equation of motion that I solve in order to get something that is computationally efficient. And so one thing that people do often because of this, all these constraints is that actually I'm going to solve the equation of motion with inertia, even if I say my particles are actually subjected to, they are immersed in a solvent, and so actually the inertia is basically completely dumped by the interaction with the solvent, as Suzanne was saying yesterday. And then I will have a contribution, so that will come, the forces that will come from the particles. And then I will have a drag term that comes from the interactions between the particle and the solvent, and that will be a function of the particle velocity. And then I will have a term. Sorry? Yeah.
Just repeat that. Extremely long equations.
Exactly. So let me continue a minute. And so I will have basically a term that contains a drag, the dissipation that it's due to the solvent. So this zeta parameter can be related to the friction, the drag term of my particles in that solvent, which will be a function of the particle velocity in some form. And then I will have a term that will allow me to impose, for example, a shear rate if I want to, for example, if I want to impose, let's say, a flow in the direction x, where z is going to be now my gradient direction. And so this is to basically connect to the experiments that Suzanne, to the protocol, let's say, that Suzanne was mentioning yesterday, where I try to impose, I deform my material by trying to impose a finite rate. Okay? So I have different ways to do this. Basically, I can tune the friction, the drag term that I have in front to make sure that inertia is not really affecting my solutions, even if I'm solving the equation of motion with inertia. So this is what I will try to do. And in fact, so there is a lot of literature about which type of terms I can have here and how I can solve the equation of motion in different ways. And I think I can. So I think that and some interesting work has been done recently, for example, by the group of Jean-Louis Barra and by Mark Robbins, for example. One interesting thing that one can find in this work is that in those works is that they show that some of those show actually that. Because these systems are very dense, actually I really need to go to very, so let's put it like that, in order to see really the effect of inertia, I have to be quite underdamped. And even if I'm not completely overdamped, I can still basically, I'm still in a condition in which inertia doesn't play an enormous role. And this is the way I understand this is because, again, the particles are so compressed against each other that I'm not going to see the effect of inertia driven, let's say, oscillation in this type of equations. Another thing that one wants to consider is that there is a lot of work that has gone in understanding what is the proper way to introduce the coupling with the solvent, and I can go all the way to, let's say, try to do something sophisticated that includes also hydrodynamics. I think that Safa showed some simulation where I actually try to take into account all these different situations. In my case, because I'm so dense, I'm going to use the idea that long-range hydrodynamics is actually sufficiently screened. And in fact, again, mainly that because I said most of the stresses actually do come from the particle-particle interaction, I'm not going to worry too much about the specific form of this, of the way I treat the solvent. And in fact, a lot of the things that I'm going to tell you, there will be that a lot of the results I will show, there will be with drag terms that maybe are not so satisfactory from the point of view of the flow of the solvent, and I should think about the flow of the solvent, but we have tested it with different type of drugs, and they basically have, we recover the same type of results. And then in these conditions, the type of choice that one makes is mainly to try to actually optimize again the computational problem and have something that I can run with large systems and for sufficiently low rates. Because what I'm interested in here is what happens in this region. Okay, as my material is being sheared, it has this overshoot, and then it reaches a steady state. How does it start to flow? Okay, so I want to be, sorry, I'm interested in actually investigating these very low rates. Yes?
Sorry, I mean, I know you spent a long time already talking about the right way to put in damping, mm-hmm. but I've been in a state of permanent confusion about this. One very often takes dense systems mm-hmm. and says that, look, it's so dense that I'll just treat the hydrodynamics as coming from a local damping. Mm-hmm. But in fact, if I take a block of stuff, no matter how dense, mm-hmm. and I apply shear across it macroscopically, if I move one wall with respect to another, mm-hmm. the only, not by imposing a profile, but by, let us say, keeping this wall fixed and moving that wall, mm-hmm. the only way that flow will be communicated across a sample is if the internal dynamics is momentum conserving. So my question really isn't about inertia, but about momentum conserving versus momentum non-conserving ways of doing the damping. And is there an objective criterion for knowing when it's okay? I know in polymers, for instance, there's a large range of length scales for which in semi-dilute solutions it's okay to pretend that hydrodynamics is free. What is the clean and honest answer in this case?
So I don't know if there is a clean, honest answer. I would get my guess, my understanding is that there is an elastic contribution to the response to the deformation. And so as long as that contribution is actually stronger, that comes from this term. That's why I was making the point that this term is more important. And so as long as that contribution is the dominant one at the rates that I am using, then my claim would be that I don't need to worry too much about that. And as a matter of fact, then I can try to vary these parameters and this way of introducing the damping in the simulations to test that hypothesis and that claim.
So, can I just add my confusion
to
this?
Yes.
So, I guess I'm confused at several levels. I mean, if you have a very dense suspension, it seems to me what you've got is almost something, okay, you're not quite up at those volume fractions, but it's almost like a, you know, foam with like plateaus and so on. So you're actually going to, is there not going to be quite a large contribution from the very thin films between the bubbles? So what you actually need to solve for is the full sort of Stokes flow in those films. So actually, if you're really going to do this quotes properly, and this is no negative comment, but it's, you know, everyone in the field does this, but what you would actually do is sort of properly mechanically do a full solid plus fluid mechanical simulation where you had, well, you could have soft solid particles, solved by some constitutive equation, and those actually properly deform in shape and then also resolve the fluid flows around those.
Yes.
And actually, has anyone ever done a sort of comparison of that kind of simulation with this?
So I'm gonna say something about this, but not really actually showing any direct comparison. But there have been, for example, studies of in the case of emulsions of models where you can try to actually describe more accurately in a more sophisticated way the interaction of the fluid around the particle and the interaction mediated by the fluid, including particle deformability and all, you know, the hydrodynamics of the fluid between squeezed between the two particles. It turns out that my understanding for the moment is that there is a number of properties that anyway, they are actually determined by the fact that the particles are so compressed to each other. If I start in the situation in which the material is completely solid, and that's the reason why a simpler model actually works.
Okay.
This is how I understand this. Okay. So we started just to give some context, and I don't want to use so much.
Could I just add another question? So the form of that drag term, I think, in most simulations is whatever you call a prefactor times V. But actually, if you think, so if I understand correctly, that's basically the result for dragging a hard sphere through a solvent But if you were actually doing, so if you think instead of actually the continuum Stokes, Navier-Stokes equation with a part of, with some sort of point force in it, you might imagine the particle to have some sort of force dragging it, you would actually, the contribution instead would be eta grad squared V. It wouldn't just be eta V, right? So that, because actually you there have forces even if all of them are moving somehow, all the particles are moving, whereas it's actually the relative motion of the particles. So,
This is what he's saying. So, this is what Sriram is saying. What I'm saying is that in these systems, when they are very dense and they start from an elastic state, actually, this fact that you are describing, and it's certainly belonging to the physics of the system, becomes less important with respect to the elastic contribution that I have from the interaction.
Okay.
This is what I'm saying.
Okay. Just one very last question, sorry. You mentioned that you have inertia in there to basically get force balance across the system and to therefore allow for heterogeneities like banding to form. If you were a fluid dynamicist, you'd be, I guess, quoting numbers in terms of a Reynolds timescale for propagation of momentum across the system, which would come from getting a dimensionless number that had the density and the viscosity and the lens of the system and so on. What roughly are those Reynolds numbers for your system?
So they would be very small and basically determined by the shear rates. And as you will see, the shear rates that I'm going to worry about are all, let's say, between 10 minus 4 and 10 minus 3, 10 minus 2 in terms of the units in my simulations.
Okay.
Does that? Okay. So what I was saying is that, for example, in this case, this study started a little bit motivated by Dan Blair's experiment, and because in his experimental system is an emulsion of droplets that are compressed, the idea was that. We started to look to use this model for the particle interaction, thinking that this was absolutely inadequate to describe what Suzanne was just saying about the interactions between the particles through the solvent. But then we got convinced that some aspects of the experiments we were particularly interested in, they were sufficiently captured, they seemed to be sufficiently captured by this type of model, even telling us that, again, there is a strong contribution to those processes that actually come from just the fact that the particles are all pushed together and they have and you have an elastic interaction through the whole system. Okay. Okay, so then what I'm going to show you is mainly probably unsatisfactory and simple-minded way to look into this, where we just impose a shear rate using Lee-Edwards boundary condition and using this type of term. And our drag, again, as you were saying, is just proportional to the velocities of the particle. Okay. And then what we are going to do is what we have done also is instead to consider the case in which my solid is actually confined between two walls, and I pull on one of the walls, and I use a drag term that instead is of this type, so it contains the relative velocity of the particle and its momentum conserving, and it's probably more acceptable. Okay, and So, as I said, that this is, I always say that this is Dan Blair's fault, because he had this very nice, this is how it all started, that he had this very nice experiment with the confocal microscope access to areometer, so he can actually image and deform the materials at the same time. And so then you can actually, you're shearing the material in this direction, and you can scan through it, through the sample in the gradient direction, and use this to reconstruct the velocity profile and to analyze the microscopic motion of the droplets in these planes along the gradient direction. And when they, let's see if this works, when they subtract the background, the imposed motion to what they measure in the terms of the droplet displacement, what they see is basically this sort of bumping of the droplets in each other, which is what is left. Basically, that is due to the deformation that you are imposing, because these droplets are fairly large and they are so compressed that you don't see any Brownian motion basically happening. So also in my case, I don't know if you notice, I'm considering sort of an athermal system, so there is no Brownian motion involved. Okay, so I don't want to actually discuss too much this what we did with them, but it was just to show you why we went on and used this model. And the reason is that basically they can, as I said, they can reconstruct the velocity profile, and they can look at the local motion of the droplets in planes along the gradient direction, and extract basically, sorry, the local shear rate, the accumulated strain, and the non-affine displacement, so the displacement in these planes, having subtracted the flow. And so what they see is something like that. So this is their flow curve, and this is in steady state. Okay. And what they see, this is the mean square displacement that it quantified this non-affine motion, basically. And this, and they actually in the experiments, which is quite unique, I think, they were able to analyze even better, even further, the microscopic displacement and to extract the distribution of the displacement as a function for a certain strain, as a function of distances, of amount of displacement, right? And so then, which is what you know, one would call a Van Hove correlation function for a liquid. And so then what they, the main feature that they see is that the amount of non-affine motion, and I want to just point out here, is that the amount of non-affine motion actually decreases as you decrease the rate, and then you can see that there is, it seems to be always diffusive, although the distribution is clearly, of the displacement is clearly not non-Gaussian, and there is a change, a qualitative change between what you see at low rate and high rate for small strains. So if you look at small strains, you can see that the mean square displacement has a different type of dependence on the accumulated strain, and the correlation function, so the distribution of the displacement, actually has a different type of tail, which is exponential at relatively higher rate and power law at low rate. And so, and you can try to understand where this difference in the rate is coming from, and you can ask the question whether maybe this is something, some microscopic signature of the fact that you have this very strong rate dependence of the macroscopic rheology. So this is the, what we try to understand in this type of work. You can read more from this, but just to show you that these are the CD results that we obtain from the simulation now, using that model with only, right, the soft sphere. And so you see that we're sure that that is wrong for the interaction between the droplets, but nevertheless, you can see that you have the same signature in terms of the change of the spatiotemporal feature correlations of the displacement if you go from low rate to from high rate to low rate at small strain. So this gave us some, again, it's related to the fact, to the thing that I was saying before, and gave us some confidence that we could use this model to understand on a more general ground some aspects of this material that are there just because they are very compressed to start with. And so we think that this is where this is coming from. So,
what's A in the, it's R over A, the G.
This is the particle diameter in the simulation, because these are now simulation data, right?
And so the, those two are the same, the red and the black are all with the same strain rates, but this is just at a different accuracy?
No. So this is a small, so what you realize is that you can see a difference in what happens at low rate and high rate if you look at small strain. So now your material...
And the bottom part is...
This is at larger strain, and these are two different rates.
But the same rate.
Sorry. I mean, yes, the same rate as before, yes. Okay, so all this because I wanted to create some confidence in what I'm going to show you, because now I want, in fact, look at the transient. So this was concerning, actually, what happens in the steady state, but in fact, we were also interested in looking what happens as you approach the steady state. So you have the material that it's that it's solid, as I was saying in the beginning, and you are pushing it through the stress overshoot. And yes.
You have an understanding of the power law tail, that's not something that's normally...
Yeah, so there is, I can say a lot of things about this, so you can find a lot of discussion in this paper. We can understand basically the, so this, let's say, just very roughly, the exponential tail is resembles sort of dynamical heterogeneities that you see typically in supercooled liquids, and when we analyze in the simulation the spatiotemporal correlation of the displacement, we do find signature of that, whereas in the case of very low rates, you can understand the power law as related to elastic type of strain in the material, and we can find traces of this when we analyze the microscopic displacement, because you can see that here the microscopic displacement, they really look like this burst and avalanches of plastic processes in an elastic matrix, very similar to what people have looked into for example, quasi-static deformation of amorphous solids. Okay.
Why should you see that more prominently for
the low rates. So,
why should you see it for the lower shear?
Yeah, because so it seems what it suggests is that at low rates, when I force my system to flow, but I'm using very low rates, it seems that I have the elementary displacement that determine the flow, let's say, in those conditions, are still similar to a collection of plastic processes that produce avalanches in an amorphous solid. But when I start to go to higher rate, these elementary displacements seem to change the phase in certain way, or at least the spatiotemporal correlation of those displacements change the shape. And so this gives you the idea that maybe this is what is happening. This is one of the origin of this rate dependence of your stress at which you flow.
So Christina. So in simple models like random feedizing models, if you ramp up the rate of, like, if you don't do it adiabatically, if you just ramp up the field at a rate, you also cut off the distribution of some. So if I say that her low rate is more like small avalanche is happening and more of a solid, if you ramp up the rate, they start superposing, and then I think it cuts off the tail or does something.
Yeah, but I don't think this is something like this, though. I mean,
could be if she's starting from that limit, right, where she's saying it's a solid with some failures in it, is the red one.
Maybe, naively I would have expected kind of the opposite,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Why the opposite?
That's what I was getting confused about too, but I think there's also the fact that you're looking at this at different strains. So there must be some time.
Yeah, so for example,
this is maximum.
Yes. Yes.
So
for larger strain, you start to lose.
Black and red. Mm-hmm. The same strain.
Yes.
Red.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes. So why you were expecting?
Important to see this, that you're looking at some characteristic strain value.
Yes. And it could be non-monotonic with this. But
those two are the same.
You're saying
it has
effect with the entire stuff when you go to the lab.
But why were you expecting the opposite? Because I don't quite understand.
No, I don't know. Naively, mm-hmm. My intuition would have told me the opposite, but that doesn't mean I now believe this.
Okay. So the idea is that basically if you think that the plasticity is setting up in this way, that you have initially your elastic background and you are producing more and more plastic events, what this suggests is that at some point you start to screen the elasticity enough that the spatiotemporal correlation in your system change, and this is what you are seeing, right? So that with this respect, this makes sense too. Okay, but this is not what I wanted to talk about. Okay, so what I was interested in is more what Suzanne was talking about yesterday, which is the fact that, for example, she also pointed out to this experiment by Thibault and Sebastian. Of course, this system is much more complicated than my stupid particles. But basically, what you see is that as the stress decays from the overshoot, they can actually reconstruct in those experiments the velocity profile. And so they can see that actually, for a long time, only part of the material is flowing while you're shearing it, and part of the material is actually stuck. And that they were seeing that this phenomenon was persisting for a very long time, and then this is related to Suzanne's discussion yesterday of how one should understand this phenomenon in terms of possible connection to steady states and so on and so forth. And here there is a collection of literature that it's very extended that has addressed this type of problems, and I'm sure I'm missing something. Okay, so this is what we see in the simulations, right? So this is our velocity profile, and this is the stress as it decays from the stress overshoot. So I think as the movie starts again, you can see that actually, basically in the beginning, only part of the material is flowing, and there is an extended part of the material that it's stuck. And until little by little, the flow, the profile becomes homogeneous, and this is, but it lasts for quite some time, okay? Even when the shear stress seems to be relatively flat.
Can I just ask what
rate
this is at, which part of
it? This is, in fact, all what I'm going to show you now about the transient is in the low rate, so in the more or less in the plateau or close to the plateau.
And why is the fixed ball different from the moving ball in a Galilean sense? Is it back to how this
So this is for the, actually this movie is for the periodic boundary condition, and there basically the stuck part can form anywhere.
It's taken to the bottom. It's about, it tends to happen next to the fixed ball.
Yeah, because the it's you, because your yeah, because you are pulling on the part that is actually done on the wall. What I'm saying is that in the case of the configuration with the wall, right, when we pull on one of the walls to induce the deformation, there is the stack part forms first to the
You have to pull on the fixed wall as well. Don't you pull on both of them in the opposite directions?
Yeah, so if we pull from both directions, maybe there is something.
Under inertia, or it's the non-Galilean damping. That's how it knows which wall is fixed. It's got to be one of those two things. I'm not sure which. The DPD one, it can also form at the fixed wall, and that's inertia. Because the startup.
Right.
It's a little bit of breaking near you. I don't know why. Through the inertial term initially, and that's usually enough to choose.
Okay, so sorry, I'm used to thinking about inertia, but I would have thought if it was inertia doing it, it would happen next to the moving wall, because you would have a front of momentum going across this.
Because the static wall is still static, so we're going to have a static band. Going to be the bit which never moved. Right?
Yeah.
Sorry, what do you mean by localization? You mean the stuck bits next to the fixed wall? Yeah, sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, no, so, yeah. So, the, yes. Okay. So, the.
Localization of the flowing bits.
Yeah, no. Okay. Okay. Yes.
Sorry.
Okay. Okay, so. Then, okay, so this is the stress as function of the strain, right? And you can basically look at the width of the material that it's actually following the deformation. And so you can see that the beginning, basically, it's the whole material is deforming. In a way, the different colors are for the rates, for different rates. So this first part basically does not depend on the rates, so it's mainly determined by the elasticity of the system. And then as you go through the overshoot, you start to form this, basically, this part of the material that is stuck and part of the material that is flowing. And the part of the material that is flowing is growing over time, and it has this sort of very slow dependence on the accumulated rate, okay? That looks nearly logarithmic, and this is fairly similar to what has been observed in experiments. And how extended is this part and how fast or slow it disappears, it clearly depends very strongly on the rate, okay? So there is this first part that is basically rate independent, and this second part that is clearly very strongly rate dependent. And if you look at, you can see that there is a connection, as you would expect, with the normal normal stresses, if you look at now, this was the shear component of the stresses, and if you look instead at the trace of the stress tensor as a function of the accumulated strain, then you can see that again, there is a first part where basically the response of the material does not depend on the rate, but then you have this very slow evolution that actually depends strongly on the rate. Okay?
So in your simulations, you always do a constant rate.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You ever looked at varying?
Not for the moment. Yeah. No, we actually have, but if you want, we can discuss.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you change the rate and
this is what you mean. Did you do step stress in the Colombo thing?
Sorry?
Didn't you do step stress in the Colombo thing?
That was on a gel.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. But it's and it was actually also a shear startup.
Sorry.
It was also a shear startup in that paper.
Could you do step stress if you?
Yeah, I think it would be very interesting to do. Yeah, definitely. Yes. Yes. Mm. Yeah.
So what's happening when the shear band apparently disappears? Is that a system size effect or it's something that...
There is a system size effect. So let me just go through.
So I mean that second jump is presumably very interesting.
This is what I think, yes. That, okay. So now what is interesting is that if I measure this fluidization time, so what is the time that the system needs to actually get rid of this inhomogeneity? If my system is small enough, then what I see is that this fluidization time that we can measure, you know, in different ways, and they, you know, we've used different ways and tried to get some consistent results. So you can see when basically the profile becomes homogeneous in various way, just to try to be consistent. And so what you see is that for a small enough system, actually the time that it's needed for the system to fluidize just goes as one of the rate. Okay, so it basically tells me that the fluidization, the getting rid of the band, can take longer just because I'm shearing slower. Okay, and so basically that there is a strain that controls how much I need to strain my material in order to get rid of the banding. This is what it seems to suggest. But if I go to larger system, I start to see something different. So I see that this fluidization time actually depends on the rate with an exponent that it's larger than one. Okay? Yeah.
Fluidization time is which the second jump.
Yes, it's when the bending, the inhomogeneity disappear. Okay? And so this fluidization time actually seems to depend on the rate for large enough system with an exponent that it's larger than one, telling me that this is not set just it's not just a strain that I have to impose on the material, but there is an intrinsic rate dependence of some process that I have triggered by shearing the material at a certain rate. And if I can find a consistent, so this is data both from Lee-Siddeworth boundary condition and using the wall, and this is data actually for the wall-based simulations with different confinement. So in that case, I can change the confinement to look at larger system sizes, and what I see is that actually the exponent seem to increase if I increase the system size. So this suggests that when I am actually trying to deform my material to make it flow and start this fluidization process, I am actually looking at the result of some dynamical process that has been triggered by the deformation, and that is partially correlated with a length scale that increases with the system size. Okay? Yes. You're not convinced?
No. So the exponent is one when you look at responses.
Yeah.
Looking at
large enough system, yeah. And so in this small system, for example, I don't even see the bending.
And then
hardly. It's much more reduced.
So dimensionally, you need something else.
Yes.
The left hand side is a time, or the right hand side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this data here is for a fixed system size?
Which one?
The lower one?
The lower one is for different system sizes, right? Because this is the system confined between two walls, and then I'm increasing the system size. Yes, yes.
So
Yes, yes.
This may be really difficult to extract out of the simulations, but would it be possible to extract the equivalent of a dispersion relation for the initial onset of the heterogeneity? So if you look at the strain rate profile, it will be initially uniform, and then you get fluctuations growing at different wavelengths, and then it will eventually be cut off at some wavelengths, which is why you don't see banding below some box size, presumably. So is that probably asking too much to get
I think it's challenging, but it's probably worth trying. Maybe I can show you, I don't know if I make it now, but I can show you also later a movie of what's happening in the motion through the particle, and so you can see why it's challenging, because the interface is actually very rough between the two things. So, but probably if we have systems that are large enough, maybe we can do that. Okay, so I'm going very slow, but let me try to get to my point. Okay, so one of the points that it's puzzling is that, in fact, if you look at, if you stare at your simulation a lot, so you realize that there is no difference that you can see between the part that it's stuck and the part that it's flowing in the structure. The system is polydispersed, so there is no crystallization, and we cannot actually see much difference between the two phases. So what we try to do is to look at how particles are packed in the system and to understand if there was any correlation between the packing, the type of packing the particle had, and whatever was happening in terms of these strange inhomogeneities. And so what we realize is that by doing a Voronoi tessellation of our system, that in fact the particles that were mainly surrounded by the decahedral Voronoi volume, so the particles that basically have locally icosahedral type of packing, they had actually a strong correlation with what was happening in terms of the inhomogeneity. And in particular, if you plot, for example, the fraction of particles that are locally icosahedrally packed, then you can see that the evolution with the strain has, bears clear connection with the dynamics of the fluidization. And, you can identify this first part that it's, again, rate independent, and then there is a very slow a decay in the amount of these icosahedrally packed particles, so that depend strongly on the rate, and also the way it decays depends strongly on the rate, in a way that seemed to be very closely related to the disappearance of the inhomogeneity. And you can convince yourself even more of that, because, for example, if I look now at velocity profiles along my load curve, and this is my velocity profile, and the dashed red line is the local amount of icosahedrally packed particles, then I can see that in the beginning they are homogeneously distributed. As the band disappear, they sort of localize in the part that it's stuck, and then the evolution of the velocity profile is correlated with basically getting rid of some of them. Okay, so there is clearly a correlation between the evolution of the amount of icosahedrally packed particles and the evolution of the inhomogeneity of the flow. Okay, and okay, so now the thing that we find that there is a certain percentage of particles that are icosahedrally packed, it's not surprising, right? People, because our system is polydispersed, is basically amorphous, and so it is, and our potential is spherically symmetric. So we know that in these conditions, we would expect to have a lot of basically local icosahedral order, and it's certainly not a surprise from this point of view. And so, for example, I think that Tani is going to talk more about their work on also identifying locally icosahedral packing and the connection with the formation of a supercooled liquid, and how this actually persists even under deformation. In this case, what was very striking to us is that so you know that basically this local icosahedral packing forms because a spherically symmetric potential will tend to favor this type of structures if you cannot develop a long-range order. But what is interesting here is that this somehow tells us that this feature is correlated, it's really connected, has an impact on the mechanics of the material, which was interesting. And so the idea that we have sort of thought that we have developed is based on the idea of over-constrained states and self-stressed states that Tom Lubensky proposed a couple of years ago. So if I think of my amorphous solid as this sort of frame, abstract frame, and I can have that part of it is rigid because it's isostatic, and part of it is floppy. And then as my material becomes more solid, I can add more constraint. And one way of adding this constraint is to adding them like that, so that basically also this part becomes isostatically rigid. But I could also think to add more constraint in terms that, you know, prevent particle motion in this way. So basically I create a part that is over-constrained, which allows me to keep a part that is still floppy. And this is something that can happen most probably in many cases where amorphous materials form and you have some kind of amorphous solidification. And what this, the idea is, that they propose is that what this over-constrained region do is that you can now accumulate stresses under load, because some of these constraints can be under tension or under compression, but still there is no net force on the particles. And so what it means is that I can accumulate stresses here without having to change the mechanical state of the material, so without locally yielding. So now the idea that that we sort of started to develop is that, in fact, these icosahedrally packed domains that basically form because it's convenient for the interaction, they are a way to introduce over-constraining in my material. They are over-coordinated, and therefore they're over-constrained. And they will act as this sort of self-stress state that will allow me to concentrate more stresses. And it's the dynamics of these over-constrained domains and their evolution, their compatibility with a certain shear rate that I want to impose, that will determine the development of the inhomogeneities and their evolution. Yes.
Well, if I look at sort of icosahedrally coordinated spheres, mm-hmm. their coordination number will not be necessarily very different from something that I pick out as non-icosahedral.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm.
So that.
So I agree with you, but in fact we can see that there is let me just go further, but in fact one point is that on the other hand we know that for this type of potential, this icosahedrally packed structure, they correspond to locally prepared structure. So it means also that they will be more stiffer because they are better, actually they correspond to deep, locally deeper minima, right?
The local minima, and they last longer.
Exactly.
They're longest lived. Mm-hmm. You can do a lifetime of these local structures and you can just see which one lasts longer. These ones last longest for this type of potential.
Okay, let me just go further and then we can discuss this more. Okay, so, but this is more or less the working idea, okay? And so then I can try to test these ideas, because in my simulation with this type of potential and with the simple model that I have, I know that I can actually induce a different amount of this icosahedrally packed structure, as Stanley was saying, by actually changing the cooling rate that I use to prepare my material. So I actually, in these simulations, what I do to create this initial configuration is that I generate a very dense liquid assembly, and then I cool it, I quench it down basically to zero temperature to make my solid and then to produce my initial sample. Now I can change the cooling rate to actually try to access a deeper minima that actually corresponds to a larger amount of this icosahedrally packed structure. And so this is the energy. So when we do this process of cooling, we can measure what's the energy of the local minimum in which the system ends when we cool at a certain rate. And you can see that if we decrease the cooling rate and we access deeper minima of the local potential energy. And then if I count, so now I have these different quantities that are plotted as function of this cooling rate. Okay? So as I decrease the cooling rate, I can see that the amount of icosahedrally packed particle is increasing. So this is what I was saying, that I can actually play with that to introduce artificially this more of these domains that are, in my view, playing this role of the self-stressed state. And then I can measure the modulus of my elastic solid. So my material, my initial configuration, it's always very elastic. So I have a plateau of G prime. If I do oscillatory shear, I have a plateau of G prime that is much larger than G double prime. And the modulus is actually larger. So my material is stiffer because I have more of these icosahedrally packed regions. And then I can measure the stress overshoot that corresponds to this different configuration. And I can see that indeed, basically, the larger amount of icosahedrally packed regions corresponds to a stronger stress overshoot. And that if I look at the first normal stress difference, I can see that this is also larger, suggesting that the more I have of this region, the more actually these stress states are compressive. Okay, so the system has a stronger tendency to dilate. So this seems consistent with the idea that I was saying before. And now, if I look again at my fluidization time and I plot it as a function of the rate for configuration that I have produced within different amount of icosahedra, I can see that in fact my exponent increases. Okay, so this suggests that the larger the amount of these icosahedrally packed regions, the more I have a tendency to develop the stronger are the inhomogeneities that I tend to develop, and the longer they will last, and this is what determines this change in this exponent. Okay, so I just want to conclude rapidly, and then we can have more questions, but basically this is my story, and I would be very happy to hear what you think about this. So Suzanne was talking about the possibility to develop this sort of flow inhomogeneities, in transient flow inhomogeneities, as you start to shear a soft glassy material. And the picture that is coming from out of this study is that this tendency may be related to the fact that you have mechanical heterogeneities to start with. And in a dense material, these mechanical heterogeneities, they could be associated to this over-constrained, to the presence of this over-constrained domain that quite, to me, obviously, they will form in any amorphous solid that I try to shear to start with, and it's the dynamics of these over-constrained domains that will interact with imposed deformation and with the deformation rate that will actually determine and control the development of transient inhomogeneities and their persistence over time. So this is.
So the time scale that the controls, you're suggesting maybe the time scale that controls the transition from the slow shear rate to high shear rate type of behavior is associated with time scale for the arrangement of
hypersahedral
cycles or something?
Yeah, so in fact, it's as you see, the amount of. You mean the time scale I was talking in the beginning?
Transitions.
Mm-hmm.
Transitions is not the right word, but you have this change in the exponent.
Right, yeah.
Depending on how quickly you strain.
Yes. And so the point is that.
Well, not the exponent, the change in your distribution.
No, because that is at the steady state. Okay, so that is where basically my amount of icosahedra have settled to a value that is compatible with the rate at which I'm shearing my material. And then when I look at the steady state, I just see that there is depending on how I shear, there is a different type of local spatial temporal correlation that may be associated to that. But this is instead in the transient. So yeah.
Suzanne
has asked before.
So there's been quite a large sort of slew of work from the French school over the last 10 or 15 years looking at flow of, I guess they call them elastoplastic materials, but I suppose this would come into this category. Where at very low flow rates, the picture, at least in a steady flowing state, is that what you have is relatively localized kind of switching or relaxation events, like almost like switching events and phones.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Then the picture of the dynamics is that any one of those causes a local stress relaxation, mm-hmm. and then but the rest of the material is relatively mm-hmm. elastic, so mm-hmm. that stress relaxation propagates then via the eosine tensor loads of mm-hmm. everywhere else, but then may cause another ping somewhere mm-hmm. else. Mm-hmm. But I guess actually, because that really does rest on there being an eosine tensor underneath mm-hmm. all of this, mm-hmm. but I guess it's sort of somehow related to this non-Galilean drag that there actually mm-hmm. there wouldn't be a long-range eosine tensor, right, because you have two factors of k squared.
But I think that it's not obvious to, I mean, in order to go there, I should do some coarse graining of my microscopic model and then translate that to see what it translates that in terms of their more coarse grained picture, right? Because these elastoplastic type of models, they are not actually directly, you know, you are not making that hypothesis on the microscopic dynamics.
Well, if I understand these elastoplastic models correctly, mm-hmm. the each event is a sort of microscopic event, but then that's coupled with global, and
yes.
literally all you have is linear elasticity.
Yes,
the
yes.
Tensor,
yes, yes, yes. But what is microscopic, it's not necessarily...
What do we mean by those words, microscopic?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But, I mean, that macroscopic stuff doesn't emerge from your picture of the equations there, if you coarse grain over them, is that...
I think that it still could. This is what I'm trying to say. That's...
Maybe, so just following mm-hmm. up on that, in all of those studies, mm-hmm. they don't give a huge distribution of heat stresses. I think what Emma is saying is that dicocedral regions have a much larger heat stress in some way than these very mobile. And so I think that kind of model with a,
so there is
with
a
huge distribution of heat stresses.
So the one,
I guess it could. I'm just trying to understand how this Eosine tensor would emerge from those equations, because they somehow have fundamentally different space properties. But perhaps it does get different if you coarse grain them.
This is what I think. Yes, and so one idea is to try to basically use, for example, local yield stress distributions. Obtained from the simulation, where by local I don't, you know, it means anyway some group of particles. Yeah. And so with this respect, there is actually a recent work by Damien van den Broek, where they develop a picture in terms of the distribution of the local yield stresses, okay. which is actually very similar to, very consistent with the picture that we obtained from here.
This work that you refer to, mm-hmm. Damien, is very appealing, but in simulations, I don't think anybody has sort of tried. I mean, whatever observations they make, mm-hmm. the elastoplastic models, mm-hmm. people haven't really reproduced them in a simulation study.
I think
in terms of looking at the distribution of local yield stresses, this is...
In terms of the full distribution of the yield stresses, you mean? Yeah, this I don't know exactly. I know that Jean-Louis, in the group of Jean-Louis Barat, they've done a lot of connection, building a connection between the, let's say, molecular dynamic type of simulation, particle-based simulation, and those models. So there is quite a bit of results in that area.
Yeah, but not specifically, I think, using this result, which is...
No. So there is, for example, there is the recent work by a PRL that came out, I think, in the fall by Jean-Louis and Kirsten, where they look at stress-imposed experiments, and they look then at the relaxation, and they get a fluidization time out of that, and that also actually scales with the shear rate, with imposed stress, but with an exponent that is larger than just one.
So, I mean, in terms of the results that you presented, you basically, I'm trying to summarize it in my head, you had looked at fluidization time. It's dependent on the strain rate, dependent on the system size, mm-hmm. and the cooling rate, mm-hmm. right? So each of them has this non-trivial dependence of the exponent.
On the rate, you mean the exponent on the rate.
The exponent being the non-trivial dependence.
Okay.
The exponent value. So what sort of, these are at one level three different observations. Right? So if you want to sort of try to relate them, I guess try to see them as arising from some length scale. Right?
Yeah, so what I should do, go ahead.
So what is the way, have you thought about how we might look?
So the thing that I wanna do is to look at the spatial correlation in this dynamics of this icosahedrally packed regions, right? So in the sense that I know where they are located, and at the moment I just say that the total number is decreasing over time, and I know that it's decreasing over time in an homogeneous way in space, but I could actually work on the dynamic, on analyzing that type of dynamics to understand what's the spatial correlation, if it's that the length scale that actually determines it. Yes, the correlation. Yeah, if you want to, the correlation between what I would call mechanical heterogeneities in my material. Everybody has their own
one. Can I ask a question? Yeah, it's kind of related to the comment that you just made. So my question was, because you just showed that the icosahedral, these clusters are related to the amount of overshoot, and the overshoot is kind of the region where it is behaving like elastic. So then my question is, like, if you sort of track the spatial distribution of these icosahedral clusters, would it be possible to identify the regions which are non-icosahedral and treat them as a defect and kind of relate the...
The way I think to the non-icosahedral part is basically the way I would like to think about it to go further and analyze the dynamics is some sort of softer elastic matrix in which these harder inclusions move, and because they are in this soft elastic matrix, they interact with each other. That's why they get localized. They get redistributed in space.
Emma, did you check for any structuring in the vorticity direction?
I'm trying to think among all the things that we did. We did check about inhomogeneities in the vorticity direction. I think we have to be out of. We did check about inhomogeneities in the vorticity direction without success. But I'm not.
It's homogeneous.
But yeah, exactly. And then I'm not actually so sure. We, in the sense that I'm saying without success more because I'm not sure that we, did it in a proper way. Okay. This is what I'm saying. So maybe there is something better that could be done.
Okay.
I have a general quick question. And we discussed it a bit before. In general, these locally driven structures depend on the potential.
Yeah, exactly.
So you
I'm not attached to icosahedra. I'm not attached to them at all.
So how did you decide the icosahedral ones? Did you do a sort of analysis of the clusters and then found out?
So this is the point. That you can do an analysis of the Voronoi volumes and realize that there is a specific more or less range. I don't say that these are perfect icosahedra, but more or less always around that shape that seem to be, this is the one where you see the strong correlation with the flow. And I just think that if I have, and of course these ideas need to be tested, that if I have actually another potential for which the over-constraining or, that will favor a certain type of structures that then can be over-constrained, these are the structures that are going to affect your flow, and they do not need to be icosahedrally shaped. So it would be very interesting to do this with other type of potential, for example, where you have different type of anisotropy, and see if this idea is true.
I guess there are a number of different sort of parameters you can look at, including local energy and, like you said, local yield size, etc. They will all be fairly well correlated with each other. So I guess even if icosahedral order is not the most appropriate structural measure,
it is,
Yeah, so saying if you go back to the Kane-Lebensky mount picture, then it's all about local coordination. It doesn't matter what the structure is, right?
Well,
in
I think it's,
like
it's more.
It's just because they look at lattices.
I have the impression that it's a bit more than this.
Exactly.
And
you have to look at something else.
And for example, in our case, is that that's why we actually tested that if you have more icosahedra, you get something that is stiffer, and you get something where the overshoot gets higher. Right.
And I guess what I'm asking is, is there another way of identifying the self-stress state?
Yeah, so the for example, I could try
in
to...
In addition to sort of coordination numbers, something else.
What I'm thinking, what I would like to do is to do things like local elastic moduli or local yield stress, for example.
But you know,
yeah, but I'm saying that I can do even without relying on this counting...
I get it. And we have discussed some of these things with Xiaomi. Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Can you continue?
No.
Yes.